standing at the station, my ticket in my hand, a one-way fare down to plow my share of broken promised land. My face against the window, my guitar in the bed, I'm bound to ride on.
Welcome to the Village Night Owl. I'm your host, Joe McSpadden. Before we get started, let's get some business out of the way. The Village Night Owl would like to thank our sponsors, Okra Magazine, the high-quality glossy magazine that covers real Southern culture, interesting stories about people and places in the South, Southern food culture and traditions, Southern writers, artists, and craftsmen. You can subscribe at okramagazine.com, and when you do, you'll get the gorgeous print edition and the digital version as well. Every issue takes you on a memorable journey. And of course, we are just as proud of our next sponsor, ChristianBaldo.com. Christian Baldo is the genius behind our super cool Village Night Owl logo. You know, our guitar-picking owl. Christian Baldo is a brilliant graphic designer and a really down-to-earth good guy. He'll take your ideas and develop concepts that are unique and that help identify your brand. He is great to work with and will create something that represents you and your message. Look him up at ChristianBaldo.com and say, "Hello, Baldo." Lastly, we would like to thank Pond 5 for our funky theme music. And just as a reminder, you'll hear sound clips during the interview, but at the end of each episode, after sign-off, we have a couple of complete tracks that'll give you a chance to really get a sense of what the artist being profiled sounds like. So hang in there, and you'll get a chance to hear some really great music. Dirk Powell is an incredibly talented musician and a living, breathing testament to the power of traditional music, especially Appalachian, Cajun, and Creole musics. He is a multi-instrumentalist and an excellent songwriter. He's also highly regarded in the world of music by his peers, people with names like Joan Baez, Eric Clapton, Tim O'Brien, and the late Levon Helm. Dirk put out a new album at the beginning of September entitled When I Wait for You. It is a wonderful record that basically, I guess I would classify it as folk, but in a specific way. Often when people hear the term folk, they tend to think of the 60s. Pete Seeger, the Weavers, the folk revival in Greenwich Village, or maybe they think of Dylan and protest songs. But folk has always been a very broad tent that included blues, field hollers, gospel, and of course these Cajun and Celtic traditions, and a lot of other genres as well. Dirk's new record is a tasty blend of all these things and more. He brings some great guests along. His daughters Amelia and Sophie make it a family affair. John McCusker and Michael McGoldrick from across the pond add a Celtic flavor to proceedings, and Rhiannon Giddens guests on the ballad, I Ain't Playing Pretty Polly. That song's about breaking with tradition. Folk music has had a long history of a sort of subgenre called murder ballads. On I Ain't Playing Pretty Polly, Dirk sings that he isn't playing anymore songs about drunken, violent men who abuse women. It's a statement to tradition, informed by his being the father of daughters. On the album, he also deftly tackles the subject of racism from a very personal angle. But the album itself isn't about issues. It's about life and the lives of real people. It's the kind of music that celebrates the little things that make life special.
So, Dirk, I'm happy to have you on here today. Really, I got to tell you, I have loved this new record. I really have loved this record. It's been in constant rotation. I can't seem to stop.
Well, that's great to hear. That's what you hope for.
Yeah. So, I've been reading up on on a little bit of your history. Tell us where you got started or when you first started to really connect to music and began to want to play it yourself.
Well, I got started at a pretty young age. My family had moved from Kentucky up to Ohio. Both sides are from Eastern Kentucky and had music going pretty far back, but it kind of made that move. When I was really young, I was just listening to recorded music, and that was kind of an oasis and a place to be removed from things, you know, family life that was challenging in moments. And so discovering music as kind of a haven, just listening to records, was a really powerful thing for me, hearing also my parents play. I started playing piano. I kind of went that direction at a young age. I guess I was about 8. And when I was maybe 11 or so, and I was going to visit my grandfather, my papa in Kentucky, that music really began to resonate with me. I began to realize, wow, this is something that's uniquely mine, in the sense that the only reason it exists in a way is to hand it off to the next generation so they can make it relevant, they can make it mean something to them and have a outlet for expression and shared, you know, social communication and all these things. And when I realized this gift that was being offered me, I really embraced it. And also then, you know, a few years after that, when I started playing it more, it was an interesting time because, of course, as a teenager, you're trying to rebel. And I was playing some other kinds of music, like punk rock and things, and things that were rebelling, but they were also still reacting to what they were rebelling against. They were engaged with it because they were resisting it. But I realized my grandfather had this music that was rebelling almost on an entirely different level because it wasn't even engaged with anything. You know, it wasn't resisting anything. I mean, that was a whole different level of rebellion to kind of be so present that it's not even engaged with, you know, certain aspects of society or your commercialism or things that I was rejecting. So I started spending more time with him in Kentucky. And, you know, I've sometimes told one story that it was a pivotal moment for me. He played a very simple banjo tune. And afterwards he said, you know, people used to think that just that was beautiful. And it was kind of an epiphany for me. It was one of those moments where I thought, okay, people used to think that just something simple and beautiful like that was beautiful. What changed? Did the beauty change or did the people change? And I realized, wow, the beauty never changed. And so people have changed. And it made me want to embrace that music and kind of go into the center of it and be a champion for it and try to convey the beauty of it to people. So that's pretty much how I got into a position of being pretty committed to playing old-time Appalachian music and convey to people that you could express, you know, anything in that tradition if you go far enough into the center of it, that there's kind of everything there. You know, you go, if you try to reach out sometimes and tell every story at once, you don't end up saying anything. If you go all the way into one story, I mean, one story that's told well can reveal everything, you know, so it's kind of that approach as opposed to grabbing outward.
You mentioned rebelling, which is kind of an interesting thing to talk about. And I want to mention, I know that you have at one time recorded a song with Levon Helm of the band. And the thing I thought's interesting about that is at a time when people were being told not to trust anybody over 30, the band was going in the complete opposite direction. Right. And I see that with your music. I mean, there is an appreciation for lives that have been lived before our time and that are enduring.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, I really feel that. I feel that, you know, in this country, you know, there's this idea that you can become anything that you want to be. You can, you know, embrace the American dream and just realize any dream that you have, you don't have to be defined by who your parents or your grandparents were. And in some ways, that's been a valuable thing in America. But in other ways, I think that's caused us a lot of pain overall in that we've severed ties to, you know, our ancestors in ways that a lot of cultures realize those ties are deeply important. And even though you may think, you know, well, I'm going to start this journey in my life and I can go be anything I want, go anywhere in the country, live anywhere, do anything. You know, if you don't know even the ground you're stepping off of, then you kind of sink into it. You know, you got to have a place, a solid thing to step off of to start a journey. And I really feel that. Yeah, I felt that in and Levon in the band, and being lucky enough to make music with him taught me a lot. Yeah, I want to also convey those things to younger generations, because I feel really fortunate to have made music with some people who really do go back to different eras and different times. I mean, when I was still a teenager and I was playing with older musicians, I was playing with some people that were born in the very, very late 1800s, which still surprises me when I think about that. But, you know, people that were in their 90s, you know, when I was 18, I mean, that's what was happening. So I guess, like I said, I feel so fortunate to have played with Levon, you know, on multiple levels. But I hadn't really thought about that aspect of it. And it's true. They also had a similar intent to kind of tell their generation, well, wait a minute, you know, if you really ignore the past and the ancestors and really don't revere that and don't find what's good in that down the road, you're the one that's lost something, I guess. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's important that we know where we fit into our own history and where we come from. Otherwise, you really have no root in the world.
Yeah, and that's been one thing about America, you know, the idea that you won't be defined by your roots, but then without roots, you don't get nourishment that you need too. So there's something in there that I think facing and addressing and thinking about, you know, will help people kind of heal some of those spots that lack a connection.
The essay you wrote about your papa, it was genuinely moving. I thought it was beautifully written. Your perspective on connecting to your ancestors, which I saw in an interview too that you had done, I just thought it reminded me a little bit of one of my favorite writers, James Lee Burke, who's always kind of evoking memories of the past. But I thought this piece that you wrote about your papa was absolutely beautiful, and it really conveyed a sense of what he had given you that was more than just a skill playing an instrument, but he gave you really a heritage.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, he gave me my life in so many ways. He gave me the things that let me live the life I've lived, because playing that music led me to my social circle. It led me to my now ex, but my wife, Christine Alpha, and our beautiful daughters. And I could say everything when I look around and take stock of my life, I trace it all back to that music and the fact that he gave that to me only with that intention. There was no reward except for the sharing of this beautiful thing and his knowing that it would live on. That was something that meant so much to him. And, you know, for me to be, I don't know, 13, 14, visiting him, and him to be in his 70s, it had been a long time since somebody revered him, if anybody ever had, you know, really, honestly. To feel what it felt like to him to be my hero was also an amazing feeling and a gift. And there's something about making music with family in that way where, you know, the communication is one that, you know, you're saying things that you maybe can't express with words. So to learn to make music that way was such a gift. And yeah, I just trace so much of my life back to that exchange and that incredible offering that he gave to me.
So when did you begin to move into playing music professionally and going out on your own and playing gigs?
When I was about, when I was in high school, I stopped going to high school. I would get dropped off at the bus station and sneak back in the basement window of my house and play the banjo all day and then leave and pretend I was coming home from school. So that wasn't sustainable thing. That didn't last too long. So they sent me to boarding school. And at boarding school, I kind of did all right at first. And by the time I came back for my senior year, I had already been living a lot of the life I live now. I had a lot of the same friends that I still have all these years later. And so when I went back for my senior year, I just kind of lost it and thought, well, I cannot be here. I can't know what the world is and confine myself to the rules of a small boarding school, you know, as a 17-year-old. So I ran away from boarding school, called up the taxi service, and they came and got me and took me to the Greyhound station, and I took a Greyhound and left boarding school. And that's probably the time I really started playing music professionally. I mean, I ended up making a deal to go back there until Christmas, which I did, and, you know, things like that. But I was really 17 or 18 when I started trying to make a living playing music. And that was pretty tough at that time. I was sort of living in my car for bunches of time and also, you know, just crashing with other musician friends and kind of in motion. I gradually kind of built it up from there. But that was mainly playing old-time music, playing some gigs, and it just... being out experiencing the world. It was, I say professional, but there was not a lot of professional income going on for sure.
The starving artist, I suppose, right?
I guess so, yeah.
So when did you get introduced to Cajun and Creole music in Dewey Balfa?
Well, I first saw Dewey in 1985 at, I guess it's not the National Folk Festival, but it's the festival they have in Washington, D.C. on the mall. They have a whole...
The Smithsonian Folklife Festival.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, exactly. So I saw Dewey there and I saw Christine there playing together. Probably about 5 years later, I was mainly playing old time music, but I was in circles where they were playing Cajun music too. And there was some overlap there, and got to meet Dewey, spent some time with Dewey and began playing with him a bit. And then met Christine and was able to start making music with her and kind of develop a relationship with her, which was turned into a marriage and a lovely life in a band and home and music for a very long time. But it was an interesting moment beginning to date Christine and playing a bit with Dewey and feeling that energy from him. He put me through the ringer a few times. One time, you know, the very first time I was around them at a festival for the weekend, I didn't play that much Cajun music at that point. He called me up on stage to play second fiddle. It's the Dewey Balfa band. And I was playing second fiddle behind him. Of course, I was mainly playing chords and things around his melodies, which, you know, you can do if you listen and don't, even if you don't know the melodies, there's a way to do that because you're kind of responding. And then he said, "I'm leaving the stage. You're going to play lead fiddle right now." And he leaned over and whispered in my ear, "Any son-in-law of mine is going to play Cajun music." And this was, you know, a week into me and Christine's relationship. So he left the stage. Yeah, I was up there with all these Cajun greats, didn't really play the music. I was suddenly the lead fiddler in the Dewey Balfa band. And he...
No pressure there, right?
Five songs. When he came back, he went in front of the stage and rosined his bow while he was looking up at me, kind of looking at me in the eye and doing this really slow rosining motion, almost like he was sharpening a knife, you know. And this is classic kind of story. I mean, this is the way a lot of this stuff works. So when he came back up on stage, he's finally ready to play. He just leaned over right before he started the tune and just whispered in my ear, "You little shit," which meant I had passed. You know?
No pressure there, right?
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. So I also see that you spent 10 years touring with Joan Baez. How did you come to be connected with her?
Well, on her record, Day After Tomorrow, Steve Earle produced that. They were kind of returning to a bit of a folkier sound for her. She'd been traveling with an electric band with drums and things. And they thought, well, we really just want to get back to the essence of the Joan Baez that people know in a way, or that they're kind of come full circle. So they made that record, and I just got a call through some connections, partly through Nick Forster, who recommended me, and just basically got a call somewhat out of the blue saying, "Do you want to kind of try out for this or just do this?" And I said, "Absolutely, of course." I mean, like many people, I remember so well the influence that Joan had. I was a little bit later than her primary period of influence there in the 60s, but shoot, I remember my mom strumming the guitar and having the Joan Baez songbook around the house, and my aunt too, and so many people who were inspired by her. You know, it's interesting because she gets a lot of attention, rightfully, for what she's done with civil rights and human rights, and that's been a huge thing for her. But at the same time, the number of people who picked up a guitar and just started singing because of her, especially women feeling, you know, empowered to just grab a guitar and open their mouths and let out a joyful sound, you know, it's pretty profound, and that doesn't always get recognized.
She paid you a great compliment and said that God gave you an overdose of talent. Kind words coming from somebody with the kind of career that she's had.
Well, I take it to heart because she absolutely has an overdose of talent herself. God definitely gave her an overdose of talent, not only musically, but as an artist, as somebody who is just an open channel for creative energy. I mean, she's a great dancer. We would all dance all the time on the bus, on the road, trying to keep our balance while we're going around curves at 70 miles an hour on the interstate, you know. And yeah, she started painting during the time I was with her on the road. And within a few years, she's painting these absolutely world-class portraits of people that she knows, you know, mischief makers, she's been calling her series of paintings. But they're unbelievable. So she's just somebody like that who, you know, she'll take a photo on her iPhone and just go, hey, look at this. And you'll look at it and say, wow, this is the most beautiful photograph I've ever seen. She's just got that artistic nature. So those words coming from her mean a lot to me, because I would absolutely say that about her 10 times over.
It seems like the music has always been kind of leading me towards eventually getting to talk to you, because I first discovered your name listening to a record by Grant Dermody, and I kept hitting repeat on the song Waterbound. I just that song was like my favorite song on the record, and I couldn't get away from it. I just kept hitting repeat on it. And of course, Eric Bibb's Deeper in the Well record. And so it's funny that I'm finally getting a chance to talk to you, because a lot of the music I was listening sort of around you was sort of kind of pointing me back in this direction. And then I bought season 5 of the Transatlantic Sessions on DVD, and lo and behold, of course, you're on there. So how did you get connected with that group of musicians?
Well, that's something I feel so fortunate about. I love that whole world of Transatlantic Sessions and those players, and they've become dear friends over the years. I guess Donald Shaw, who produced this record and co-produced it with me, he has an ear out for people in different traditions who are doing things that he feels are important or powerful in some way. And he booked the Celtic Connections Festival in Glasgow, which is an amazing festival. And so I would have played that festival a few times just on my own. I played it playing with Balfour Tutu or playing Cajun music. And I guess I was on his radar a bit, and he asked me to participate in that. And also Jerry Douglas, who, along with Allie Bain, the two of them kind of run that show. So I'd known Jerry since I recorded with Tim O'Brien in the mid-90s. And I guess somehow, yeah, it just evolved to the point where they asked me to be part of it. And that's a wonderful call to get. You just feel honored and thrilled to walk into something like that. So I was part of those tours and those shows at Celtic Connections, and gradually part of the TV show. And yeah, those players, I've been talking about them a little bit with this record. It's a really interesting mix, the kind of music they make in a situation like playing on a record like the one I just made. You know, they're always in service, but they also know that being in service sometimes means stepping out. And that's such a rare and beautiful thing. You know, some people kind of want to be in the spotlight, and other musicians like them have this facility and this musicality and ability where they can perform in any situation at an absolutely world-class level, but they never have to be in the spotlight. And on When I Wait For You, when I got their tracks, some of them we did live in the studio here, some of them they did overseas and sent them to me. And, you know, doing something like getting those tracks and putting them in into a recording session, it's an amazing thing, because you hear all this beauty, all this support, and then you hear these moments where they just decide to up the ante a little bit, and somebody will step forward and do one thing that adds a lot. The beautiful thing is that even that is never done from an egotistical place. That's done from, you know, contributing it's almost like a spice in that moment or something that's going to give it even more. And I love that. That's what I find so profound about those musicians, that they do just what will add, including stepping forward when somebody needs to jump up and kind of goose it up and give it more.
It's almost like an instinct in a way.
It really is. They're like, I mean, it's a comparison that's been made and could be made, but they're like athletes, and it's like a team. You know, it really is. It's a team that works together. And sometimes you have a captain leading the charge, and sometimes that captain, there can be different kinds of captains, right? There can really be the one that inspires by always taking the shot, you know, or whatever. Or there can be the one who you know, passes the ball all the time and leads from behind, kind of, and encourages and you know, inspires. And, you know, it really is a similar level of being open to the flow. I guess that's the biggest part of it, is, you know, removing blocks from the flow of energy and sort of into your body and allowing it to come out without it being inhibited. And that's the same for athletes and musicians.
You said
goals
in the
and different things, but that same kind of presence where you just, you know, you remove the mind or the analytical thought and try to let it flow through.
Yeah, you said in an interview back in 2007 that surrendering your ego is the surest way to let true inspiration through in any context.
Creating from your deepest place, yet knowing that it's in service of something else, is liberating, which I thought was a great comment because, first off, it feels very true. But secondly, it's a little bit in opposition to the current pop idea of self-promotion.
Yeah, the whole relationship to the ego as an artist is such an interesting thing. I guess in a way, that's what I was just talking about. You can't only stay in the shadows and kind of allow that to mean I'm always in service in the sense that I never step forward and bring all that I can bring, because, you know, that's not a service in the end if you're not bringing all that you have. But it is liberating, I think, to kind of turn over that attachment and that sense of self and just say, you know, this art does not come from me, it comes through me. And allowing yourself to be a vehicle that way is really the most profound thing, I think. And I think a lot of great artists, they understand that. They know that they're not the source.
I really enjoyed the songwriting on this record, and I really love, all of the music, but I thought the video for Olivia was very, very touching. And I think in this summer, where we have so much discord and so much trouble in the news, just the simple beauty of seeing children playing in the natural world, along with this beautiful melody and the words that go with that song, I found that video very moving. I mean, it was very touching to just see the simple beauty of children at play.
I see the girl who delights in all the world, Olivia. She shares a name with the woman you became, and they really are the same, Olivia. Olivia.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. I felt very moved by it as well. And those are my neighbors. They're right next door, the Thibodeaux. They're six kids, nine and under. And their parents very graciously allowed them to be in the video, and it meant so much to me. And the song basically ties to the feelings I had when I saw pictures of a former relationship partner of mine, Olivia. And I saw pictures of her from the 70s, and it just evoked that feeling for me, remembering that era and that feeling of childhood innocence and playing and just being outside and running in circles and laughing and playing games. And in seeing those photos, I thought about, okay, well, I see the girl that she was in these photos, and I see who she is now. And I see how that person lives in this one, how they're the same, and how time has passed, but how it also hasn't in a way, because there is no time. It's just something that humans invented, you know, to block things into smaller and smaller sections, you know, when really it's just one big moment in the end. And I felt really, really grateful that those beautiful kids could be in the video and bring that spirit, because that dancing and everything that they're doing and the running and the joy that they have is all so legitimate. I mean, they're in it, you know, and they were so delighted, and they're such delightful people, that whole family. So yeah, I really did want to evoke some of those feelings that sometimes feel like we've lost, especially as you say, this summer where people have been isolated and kind of keeping to themselves more, to just feel some of that childhood, but also sort of timeless joy to allow that to flower. It felt really good.
Yeah, for me, I felt like the video was something that, at least for me, I needed right now. I thought that was wonderful. There's a lot of great sort of themes in the songwriting on this record. You know, sometimes when you talk to songwriters, they say, well, you know, I don't know where it comes from, or I didn't realize this was coming through the music. And sometimes I've talked with people and they said, oh, I wasn't even aware we were saying that, you know. And I think sometimes maybe you're drawing from your papa and from other people, from other spirits, so to speak, to communicate something. But this record is very affirming and very, even though it touches on sadness and loss, there's overall a very warm and humane spirit behind it.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. That's exactly what I intended. And sort of the colors of it, the warmth of it, the sounds of it, the themes of it. I really wanted it to be like the song Everything Is All Right, which is just that, you know, everything is all right. And in some ways, that's why it's called When I Wait for You. I hope that the listener feels like that's addressing them in a way. And that this is the music I make, you know, late at night when I might be waiting for a lover to arrive or the muses to arrive, or I might be waiting for, you know, something to arrive. And yet if it never arrives, the presence being in that space is all right. It's okay. And in that space, this is the kind of art that I make. You know, this is the song. These are the songs that I write in that time. And it's meant to kind of evoke that feeling. And so, yeah, it's really, it means a lot to hear you say those things. That's my intention. I really want it to feel just the way you described.
Yeah, and I think that's borne out in other songs like You Will Live, Love, and also yeah. The Little Things, which I think is wonderful because we can get caught up celebrating big things, but it is the little things that really make everything else valuable.
It's really true. Those are the things that I think when you love somebody, gosh, it's usually those things that you remember, they stick in your mind, or those are the things you can't explain. You know, you can explain why somebody's whole life approach resonates with you, their big choices, you know, how they maybe treat other people, their values, the way that they express love and things like that. But it's those little things to me that you can't explain, you know, literally why does the way somebody drive just knock me off my feet, or why, you know, I didn't put this story in there. I almost put it in the song, but I didn't. But with my ex, I was playing croquet, you know, and she just decided during one turn of croquet to never take aim, to just play it as fast as she could, just never stopping, going active, 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 shot after shot after shot. And it was just this moment, this, why would somebody do that? Why did you choose to do that? I have no idea. But that just knocked me out. Like, that just increased my love even more than I could imagine. And why? I have no idea. But there's something about that. And I wanted to capture that in that song. You know, it's not the huge, big choices that do that thing with love that we can't explain. It really is those little moments that reveal more, I think, in a way, about somebody that are unconscious.
So now you've got this studio, right? And you're able not only to go out and make music, but you're able to bring the music to you, which I saw somewhere you had mentioned, now that your daughters are growing, that you wanted to be able to do that. It's got to be pretty rewarding to be able to bring the music to home.
Yeah, it really is. And my studio here in Louisiana has that energy in it. And it kind of is like the record in a way. It's kind of a warm space. And it's intended to be inspiring, but also relaxing kind of at the same time. Some studios feel a bit sterile, or there's a lot of metal and glass, and sometimes they're a little bit intimidating, or they don't quite have the warmth that tends to be part of the music. So I wanted to make a space that has that feel, and it has some history, and there's a lot of wood and a lot of color. And yeah, to be in there recording feels amazing, and to have my daughters sing on this record. They sang a lot of background vocals. It was such a pleasure to do that with them. And, you know, we grew up listening to so much music together and have this kind of vocabulary that we share, and to just say, let's embrace that fully on this record.
In keeping with the theme of family, I saw somewhere where you had mentioned, I think it was on E-Town, that Say Old Playmate comes from a story that about your father. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, that song I wrote based on a story that my father still tells about being a young boy in Kentucky and his best friend being African-American. And one day the adults in his family just saying, you all can no longer be friends. And it's a very common story. So many times when I play it live, somebody will come up to me afterwards and express how they went through the same thing, you know, on one side or another, that experience. And I still see the look of hurt on my father's face when he tells this story. Now he's in his 80s. You know, when something traumatic happens, a lot of the time we get kind of frozen emotionally in that moment. And I could see that. I see the look of a hurt 9-year-old on his face when he tells this story. He turns his head to the side, his eyes get this look of confusion, and his mouth this look of pain. And, you know, he processes logically why this happened. I mean, everybody knows the horror of race and the way it's all evolved in this country. But, you know, he still feels so much pain about it. And so I wanted to write that song, which basically tells that story and then pretty much has him addressing his former friend now and saying, you know, where are you now with the grandchildren? Do you tell them about our friendship? And do you tell them as a warning, you know, or do you tell them, no, love conquers all, which is the last line of the song, which, of course, is the message that I want to affirm. But it's a very common story, and unfortunately, but it's a song that dives into that feeling. And playing it when I am around him, I look out and see him listening, and I see that same look on his face. You know, he's just, he still can't process it. And I guess I can be grateful to have been raised generation down the line, you know, where I was raised by him and my mom, and there wasn't any of that, thank God. So I guess some progress gets made, although we're seeing the lack of it right now, too.
I think the way that you told the story in the song was significant, because a lot of times when there is a moral to a story or to a song, it tends to come off deliberately like a moral or deliberately like a sort of a sermon and can be preachy. But I think what you did with that was you let us in on your father's pain, and that tells the story much better than any sermon or any moralizing at the end of it all.
That's a real struggle we have with art. I think sometimes, you know, if you really have a message to convey, it's tempting to just say it directly. But then you're removing that ability for the listener to discover it for themselves. And that's how messages really get in, as you just described. That's painting it through metaphor, you know, allowing it to be discovered is really important. A lot of great songs, you kind of have to meet them in the middle. You fill them in with your own life story or your imagination. And I'm struggling with that right now. I keep trying to write this song called The Scale of the Cover-Up, The Scale of the Crime, which to me is talking about white supremacy basically being a cover-up for the biggest crime in the history of the world, which is what's happened with the Native American population and with slavery and things for the last 500 years. It's like, well, that crime is so massive. Yeah, the cover-up is this complete fabrication about a race that does not actually exist. And I keep trying to write that song, and I'm coming up against that challenge. I don't want to be preachy in the sense that I'm just stating what I just said in a song. I want it to be something that is discovered by the listener. So I do feel exactly what you just described, and that's one of my goals as a songwriter, is to paint images and to tell stories in ways that maybe bring realizations or feelings to people, but it's not supposed to be a sermon. I mean, a sermon can be a sermon, or a speech can be a speech, but I don't want to do that. I'm not a preacher. You know, I want to be an artist who reveals things to people, and it also does things that are open to interpretation that can be felt in many different ways.
I think it was on this song very affecting and very effective in giving you that sense of loss that transcends where your logic, it just sort of sets it aside and just lets you feel the pain. And I think that's really the way the song stays with you. You get that, and you really feel the hurt that these people went through.
I'm so glad. I mean, not that I intended to hurt anybody, but I'm so glad that you feel that way, because that's absolutely my goal.
Well, I think that kind of hurt is good for us. It keeps us human. I think it's the kind of thing that when you listen to that, if you're sensitive to it, I think it's the kind of thing that keeps you human.
I agree. And those stories need to be told so that we don't do that to future generations of kids. And yeah, that means a lot to me.
There's a couple of songs on this record that when I listened to them, I felt very much sort of a connection to the band. Say Old Playmate was one of them. I could hear it almost as if Richard was singing it along with you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a compliment. Yeah, I take that to heart. Thank you.
The other was The Bright Light of Day, which I could easily hear Rick and Levon, you know, trading verses on. They just have that sort of earthy, very natural feel to them. I just thought they were wonderful pieces of music.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I definitely have a relationship to that music of the band and Levon. And in some ways, it's directly listening to them or getting to play with Levon. In other ways, it's drawing from the same well, you know, of this kind of folk root and this Southern music mixed with a certain artistic intention that's kind of going outward to reach anyone who wants to tune in, you know. So there are definitely some relationship there, both directly and just in having the same kinds of inspirations. But the one thing I love about having got to play with Levon, and I try to convey this to younger generations too, is as deep as you can go, go there, you know, as far back into that pocket as you can put that offbeat, put it there, you know, don't hesitate to feel this all the way. There's no too far in terms of a feel and getting in that pocket and where that rhythm lives. And he's one of those artists who, you know, he could be playing any snare drum and it would sound the same. You know, he would make it sound like him. And I had a really interesting experience recording with him that was really informative to me, just in terms of a musical thing about feel. I tracked the song with electric guitar live with Levon. And so when I was feeling where he put that offbeat, of course, that's that beautiful place that he put it that means so much on all those records. And so, you know, I'm feeling that backbeat kind of just held in this perfect place, you know, and it's that, again, coming from Arkansas and stuff, it's like that pocket that, you know, that exists coming out of that soil. So when I'm playing the electric guitar live and I'm feeling the offbeat, it's kind of back a little bit, you know, and then I went to play bass. I overdubbed bass on it. When I was feeling where the bass drum hit, the kick drum, it was kind of a little bit on the front edge. And so I realized, wow, there's this tension right within Levon's playing. That's so satisfying, and that's part of what this is. It's like this tension and release the whole time, and it was really an experience to feel that and go, wow, you know, because a lot of what makes Southern music what it is that kind of thing. Some people a little bit up on it, some people a little behind, some people swinging, some people not swinging. A lot of classic New Orleans music is like that. Some members of the band are swinging, and then some aren't, and to feel that from Levon just within his own playing was kind of a real lesson, an amazing moment to me.
What is it about music from the South you think that makes it so memorable?
Well, I think clearly the culture in the South, the African heritage of it is enormous, and that mix with the other elements of culture in the South, it's created something that it's resonated around the world. I mean, it really has. Things like the drum set, even coming out of New Orleans, there's hardly a culture in the world right now that hasn't been influenced by or doesn't have in some part of their culture the drum set. You know, even if it's what a progressive branch of a tradition or something, well, almost everybody has that now, and that came out of New Orleans. You know, the things that combined in the South are just unique, and the power of that has resonated around the world. And the culture, you know, the food, you know, I mean, I was up in Arkansas last weekend. I guess it's been last weekend, maybe a little longer now, but I was driving back and I had to get gas. And I stopped at a gas station, Southern Arkansas, and I hadn't eaten lunch. So I went in there and, you know, this is typical, but this gas station had the best food I've had in years, I think. I mean, just like, oh, I'm going to get some gas. Oh, look, they're serving chicken and dressing and fried okra and, you know, incredible collard greens and cornbread, and you know, and there's 10 other things to choose from. And I just, you know, here I am at a gas station. I'm like, this gas station in Arkansas has better food than a lot of restaurants in a lot of parts of the world, you know. so much attention in it too, and just love and kind of understanding, you know, and blew my mind. The chicken gravy on top of the chicken and dressing all cooked together. I was like, wow. And just in a styrofoam container at a gas station in the middle of the country. So, you know, all those things, I mean, I'm just, you know, and I live in a place in Louisiana where that same kind of thing happens all the time. Of course, it's Creole Cajun foods, different kind of cuisine, but yeah, you just happen across some place and you're like, oh, wow, okay, this is the best band I've ever heard, or this is the best food I've ever tasted all of a sudden, randomly on in some roadside spot. And that's really unique. And that's what I think people respond to about the South for sure. One of the things.
Yeah, I asked Tommy Malone of the Subdudes that, and he said it was humidity. But you know, it's funny. I was it's been a really great year for music coming out of the South. I've been really knocked out by some of the records this year. Obviously, Marcus King's record was really good. Three albums that I really love this year, you know, came right out of Louisiana: Sonny Landreth and Carrie Morin's, and your record. All come out of basically the same area. It's just so fresh. I don't know. There's something about it that is just enchanting.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah, Sonny, I mean, anything he does is going to have that extra level of intention and groove and feel and expression. I mean, he's an incredible artist. I'm fortunate to be in the same community with him here. But yeah, this area really does have a kind of blossoming creativity. It's just a lot that exists here that kind of grows up out of the soil. And it's one of those places that's socially engaging in that way. You know, you walk into a space and it's already assumed you're part of something. You know, if people are in the same room, then they're creating something together. You know, if it's just a night, that's going to be a great night to remember. You know, we've lost some of that temporarily during this pandemic, and that's been hard to feel, you know, because that was such a big part of this area. But yeah, maybe some of that is going a little bit inward right now, and maybe that's okay. Maybe we're watering the roots a bit, you know, focusing, and more blossoms will come out of that. I hope so.
Yeah, I think after this, I don't know what you call it, this sort of self-imposed quarantine begins to lift and we go back to seeing music live and in person again, I think there's just going to be just this explosion of excitement and creativity.
I really think so too. Yeah, I think we're not going to take anything for granted. Not that we did before, but yeah, the first, there's a vaccine or whatever happens, you know, the first moments when we really feel like we can be close together again, dancing, celebrating, I think it's going to be explosive.
I got to say, McCusker and McGoldrick seem like they just are just perfect fit for you and for your music.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, they're just such amazing musicians and deep players. And they really do what I was describing a bit earlier, where when they're in support, they're always adding all their soul and everything to whatever they're doing. But then when they need to lead the charge a bit or step up and declare something, you know, it's almost, okay, well, here's a moment where I'm going to declare what I'm feeling right now and say it in a very present way. Then they do that, you know, but it's never done. They're never a look at me people, and not at all. And that's an incredible thing to be that talented and that, you know, musical and that adept and that gifted, and then use that in that way where it's just beauty continually. And yeah, John McCusker just adding fiddle parts, but also string parts where you kind of layering strings together and making something happen and putting that much effort into it to create worlds, you know, within the songs. I feel really fortunate to be able to ask them to participate in both, you know, live in the studio and doing things remotely. McGoldrick and Donald Shaw and James McIntosh came to the studio in 2017 when we started working on it, and I was supposed to go pick them up in New Orleans and drive to Lafayette, but my mother was sick at the time, and so they had to take the Greyhound, which, you know, for people from Scotland, Ireland, England, you know, to arrive into New Orleans and then get on a Greyhound to Lafayette, it's just diving into Louisiana completely, you know. So by the time they even got off the bus, they were already in the zone and went in the studio and recorded, and the music began to take on a little bit of a different feel already. We had a little bit of a swing, and they, like you say, the humidity wants to put more space between the notes or something. Then I brought them out to these Zydeco clubs, and there's a tiny little Zydeco club called O'Darby's here in Louisiana that's an incredible little roadhouse, and it was great to bring them to that O'Darby's. I thought about all the other kinds of O'Darby's they might have gone to, you know, O'Darby's pub in West Clara or something like that.
Yeah.
O'Darby's Zydeco Hall in Carmichael, Louisiana, different thing. But yeah, it was beautiful, beautiful to feel those guys.
So I think my last question, having read this absolutely wonderful essay that you wrote, what would you think this record would mean to your papa?
I think it would touch him deeply. And you just reminded me of a moment, actually, that kind of gives me the chills. I hadn't thought about it in a while. Actually, yeah, it was kind of making me tear up a little bit when I was maybe 14, I don't know, maybe 15, something like that. And I was playing the fiddle. And I hadn't been playing the fiddle that long. I've been playing banjo a little bit longer. But I was at his house in Ashland, Kentucky. And I heard the fiddle, and he said, hold on a minute. And he had me go over by the phone. And he had one good friend. He didn't have a whole lot of friends, but he had one friend who he particularly felt close to. And he, you know, he dialed him up on his old rotary phone and just held the phone out for me to play for his friend through the phone. And then he just laughed, and he got this big grin on his face. And when he put the phone back to his ear, and he was just laughing with his friend, basically like, do you hear that? You know, and sharing that. And that was such an incredible moment. So I know what it meant to him that the music lives on. And I think this record would mean a lot to him. I think he would hear it and get this grin. You know, I think he'd just think, wow, did you hear that? You know. It's a meaningful thing to imagine him hearing this record and knowing how much the music that we shared has brought to my life.
That moment on the phone was a tremendous validation for you.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. It meant so much to me at that age to think, yeah, this delights him and fills him with pride and in a non-self-conscious way. It's just something he wants to share. He knows what it'll mean to his friends who are both Eastern Kentucky people of that generation who grew up with that music. Yeah, it was really one of those moments that were kind of pivotal for me.
I could relate to your story of going to visit him over the summers when you were younger. I did that for a few years, coming up from North Carolina to Maryland and Virginia, and spending time with both my father's parents and my mother's parents, and just being able to be in their presence without my siblings around, without my parents around, was really a sort of validation of myself as an individual outside of my place within the family.
Yeah, those relationships are so important to us, really true. Yeah, that direct line without any other people around or any other kind of considerations, I think it's really important. I can see that for sure.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. Thanks for asking such informed questions and having really listened in. And it was really a pleasure.
You can get Dirk Powell's new album, When I Wait for You, at Amazon.com or on his website, DirkPowell.org. Stick around. We've got a couple of great tracks here for you. The first one, Olivia. The second one, The Bright Light of Day. For now, this is the Village Night Owl, signing off.
I see the girl who delights in all the world, Olivia. She shares a name with the woman you became, and they really are the same, Olivia. Olivia, Olivia, how does your garden grow? Olivia, Olivia, my heart wants to know. You see the boy whose eyes are full of joy, Olivia. He shares a soul with this traveler brave and bold, this lover growing old, Olivia. Olivia, Olivia, what flowers do you sow? Olivia, Olivia, where do the hours go? The light in your eyes brighter than the winter sky, Olivia. The warmth of my skin always seems to draw you. Oh, station, my ticket in my hand, a one-way fare down to plow my share of broken promised land. My face against the window, my guitar in the bay. I'm bound to ride all through the night to the bright light of day. Well, Uncle Clyde told me before he rose above, you'll have more fun living on the run, but you'll never be more loved. I burned candles, I burned bridges, burned whatever blocked my way. I'm heading south, put those fires out in the bright light of day. Bright light of day, bright light of day. I sing my song as I roll along, the darkness fades away. The bright light of day, bright light of day. I turn my eyes to the eastern sky and bright light of day. They say you can't go home again, but can you ever leave a place where you learn to love? Well, I don't know how or when I earned this reprieve, but thank God they called my blood. To face the music and face some demons too. When you look close, you don't see no ghosts. They look a lot like you. Breakfast on the table, I give my thanks and pray. Cause Myrtle's eyes don't tell no lies in the bright light of day. The bright light of day, the bright light of day. I sing my song as I roll along, let darkness fade away. The bright light of day, the bright light of day. I turn my eyes to the eastern skies and the bright light of day. I'm gonna make amends for this story in the bright light of day.